Margot, would you like to give us a perhaps slightly different conservative view? I don't know.
Well, thank you, Lord Kerr. I think if you got all 320 Conservative MPs in the room, you'd get a slightly different, nuanced view from all of us. But I agree very much with a lot of what George has said, and I certainly congratulate his department and the ministers responsible for the dramatic improvement to the common fisheries policy and the bringing it back to member states who are affected. And I would like to see more of that in more areas. It's really a question of how we get there. A little bit about my journey to a more pro-European perspective than perhaps some of my colleagues in Parliament. Before I entered Parliament, I ran a business. I started it myself in the 80s, and I ran it. It was just a UK business in public relations and marketing services to pharmaceutical companies. When I sold my company to WPP, I took the opportunity of creating, out of a disparate group of companies with offices all across Europe, a pan-European network in which my company was just one player. And it was those two or three years in that job which converted me to a more pro-European position. I found that certain nationalities, certain member states, if you like, were more creative, were more profit conscious, were perhaps more investment conscious. And I found that sometimes, if I sacrificed my own company's immediate short-term interests in the UK and worked perhaps more closely and gave a bit more of the cake to perhaps my Spanish or my German affiliate, to name the two best ones, that overall, when we were pitching for global business from pharmaceutical companies, we won more than we would have done if I'd pursued my own narrow commercial interest of which characterised my old company. And that, I think, is a sort of small corporate example of why, by pooling a degree of sovereignty, I think we can get a bigger slice of the cake for Britain. And in that sense, I think there is certain areas, as George identified, where we need more member state power and less European direction and regulation. And there are other areas where we need more Europe. And the single market is definitely one of those areas. As Nick Clegg said in his opening remarks, it is far from complete. And to pull out a few of the areas like energy, digital and services, which he did, is one part of the story. But I think the other part is that we need to remember that the single market is not just there to facilitate business. That is a misnomer. The single market is made up of hundreds of millions of consumers, business and a regulator. And I think that we have got to, if we want to face the British people in a few years' time, should there be a referendum, we have got to engage with those consumers and make the public realise what they have to lose by withdrawing from this single market and what they have to gain by seeing more of it completed. And we've heard that energy prices might come down by 14% if we complete the single market in energy. We've heard that digital offers a significant increase in our GDP. Online purchases per head of population are greater in Britain than any other European market. We have a lot to gain by closing that market in digital. And finally, we have a huge amount to gain by completing the market in services. This will not be easy. I fully appreciate that. Countries guard their professional, the professions within each country guard their professional standards and regulations, which, you know, over hundreds of years have really been designed to keep people out very jealously. So it will not be easy. But Britain is the second largest exporter globally of services. And we currently run quite a worrying trade deficit with the rest of our colleagues in Europe. And by completing the single market in services, I think it would enable us to close that gap. And my final point, if I've still got time, Mr. Chairman, is back to the engagement of the public, back to the engagement of consumers.
We know in this country, and I don't think it would be that much different in other member states, that the public are feel that they face huge global corporations, whether it be Google or Microsoft allegedly not paying their taxes, or whether it be the big energy companies. There was a time, you know, in the 60s and 70s where individual country companies probably accounted for more of a nation's GDP than they do today. Now we face these huge global operations, and individual countries, in my opinion, do not have the power to stand up to these organisations. And you, when you look at the powers that the European Competitions Authority have and compare them to the national institutions, I think we can only really satisfy members of the public here who feel that we are at the mercy of these giant organisations by addressing some of these accountability issues through the European Union, whereby we have the power collectively to make these large global corporations accountable to somebody, at least.
Thank you very much. I agree with a lot of what you say, but how do you take the trade-off with sovereignty? I mean, if you take energy, Article 194 has the carve-out saying it's entirely up to the member states to set their energy mix themselves. I don't think that Nick Clegg got his 13% saving in electricity prices number out of the CER. I don't know what basis it's derived at, because if there were a single energy policy in the European Union, it would presumably be a mix of the three aims of keeping the lights on, keeping the costs down, and keeping the emissions down. I don't know where that would settle. But when it was suggested in the convention that the treaty should be amended to create a serious article on which you could build a common energy policy, only four member states supported it, and the United Kingdom was one of those that was most fierce in saying that it's necessary to have a carve-out. This is an aspect of national sovereignty. People decide their own energy mix. Has the Conservative Party softened on that sort of issue now, or isn't it unthinkable that they would agree that the carve-out should be removed?
I think that on the energy market, if you could have the single market operating in terms of regulations and targets of where we want to see the European energy market operate, then I think that it's quite feasible to aim for the single market to operate within the energy field while still having some freedom within member states to operate their own policy.
Thank you. Caroline Lucas, you probably have a slightly different view on how that these three aims of energy policy should settle. Please.
Well, thank you very much. And I wanted just to start by saying how much I welcome the fact that there are now some strong voices speaking on behalf of a positive case for remaining in the EU. I don't agree with everything that Nick said or indeed everything in the CER report, but I am very relieved that it feels like the fight back is happening. I think for far too long, those who want to withdraw from the EU have had the running of the arguments, and so I'm glad that we've started fighting back. In terms of the priorities for reform, let me just say one very quick one, which is by not the most important one, but it was the one that Nick mentioned about the travelling circus, and it's just one that's close to my heart, having been an MEP for 11 years and had to go between Brussels and Strasbourg the whole time. It's not just the cost of that, although that's significant, 15 lorry loads of trunks, 2,000 staff, 1,000 journalists and policy advisors and so forth going backwards and forwards between Brussels and Strasbourg. But we also calculated, I did a report back in 2007, and we calculated that that whole circus also emits 20,000 tonnes of CO2 extra per year, which is more than some smaller countries actually emit. So there's a very good green argument as well as an economic argument for stopping the travelling circus. But more substantively, when it comes to restructuring and reorganising and priorities for reform, I mean, I do differ with, I think, almost everybody so far, and maybe it's because of my legacy within the European Parliament, but I actually think it's the European Parliament that needs more powers. I think it's really significant that there isn't an MEP on the panel today. I kind of query that. I think that's interesting. We still have the MEPs still have no power of initiative. You know that also that we don't have the right to elect the president of the EU Commission, for example. And, you know, there's a catch-22 when people say, well, MEPs aren't held in that much esteem and people don't really care about them. Well, that's because they are perceived not to have much power, you know, and so it's a chicken and egg. If you want to have greater democratic, accountability and legitimacy, really, within the EU, then I think giving MEPs more powers rather than fewer is part of that equation. But as well as addressing that democratic deficit, I think a real issue we need to address as we go forward is what I would see as a much broader crisis of legitimacy. You know, we're having a very nice internal conversation out here, but if you went out and spoke to people on the streets out there and said, you know, what does the EU mean to you? What's it for? I don't think most people would be able to give you any, you know, coherent argument at all. You know, in the very early days, it was very clear what the EU was for. It was for building peace and prosperity within the EU through a free trade project, and it's been pretty successful at doing that. But in a sense now, I think it needs to refresh what it's about. And I think if it only sees that in very narrow economic terms alone, then it risks leaving behind huge numbers of people who would otherwise be supporters. And so that's why I think we do need a new big idea for the EU. And it won't come as a great surprise to you to learn that, from my perspective at least, I think part of that big idea has to be about the EU being a real leader in sustainability. And that's not just because, you know, I'm a passionate supporter of environmental issues, but also if you're looking at it in terms of jobs across the EU, one of the fastest ways of getting more jobs would be a major investment in renewable energies, energy efficiency, far more labour-intensive than more fossil fuels. That would get a lot more people into work. So a big project. In the last European elections, we talked about what we called a Green New Deal, which was basically the idea that you would go away and try and insulate every home across the EU. That would be a massive job creation project. It would also get emissions down. It would get people's fuel bills down. There are some real win-wins out there. But it feels to me that we've got to talk to ordinary citizens. Margot, interestingly, when she spoke, was talking about consumers, and of course EU people are consumers, but they're also citizens, and I think we need to have more of a sense of what it means to be a member of the EU and not to measure that solely in economic terms, but to have a bigger debate about identity, I guess, in a sense as well. So a big idea, a new narrative, one that has the environment and social justice at its heart, but also, yes, some more reforms around democracy and accountability. You know, I think on subsidiarity, I think there is a dilemma between wanting the EU to get ever deeper, but also to expand it as well. I don't know that you can go on doing both of those things. I think you need a prioritisation, because as we get deeper with more and more members, then the democratic deficit, if you like, gets higher. The number of countries that feel that their voices aren't being heard in that institution become louder. So I think that, you know, we do need to make some choices here. And from my perspective, at least, I think that the soft power that the EU can exert by getting wider is more important than trying to get ever deeper. And Nick gave his example of the chocolate directive that took 15 years. My example would be around the hours we spent debating the decibels of lawnmower noise that was going to be appropriate within the single market, which seemed to me a level of detail that could well be left, if not to national level, then probably to parish councils. So I think there is an argument to be saying that we need to be looking much more about subsidiarity, looking more about internal democracy, but also talking finally about values. In my question to Nick earlier, I was saying that sometimes, sadly, it does feel as if there can be a contradiction between being a community of values and this leaner, meaner economic superpower. And it feels to me that we have to try to reconcile those. And that's why I was so alarmed, and Charles and I won't agree on this, about the idea of taking out the human rights clauses from free trade agreements. I would differ from Charles when he says this is a sort of an arrogant imperialist approach. If you look at, for example, the way in which the agreement is framed in the EU-Israel Association Agreement, which isn't a terribly good example, actually, because it's never been used, but it's there and it should be used, and it's also mutual. It's not just saying if country A, with whom we have a free trade agreement, infringes its human rights, then we have a right to end the agreement. It's two ways. It's also if we, you know, infringe human rights, then they have a right to close those agreements too. So I think that putting values back at the heart of the EU is important, and having that narrative and that big idea is going to be absolutely crucial if we're going to re-inspire citizens with a sense of what the EU is for. So instead of in conclusion, instead of just having a debate about more EU or less EU, I think a prior question is what for EU, and we've got to get better at answering that question.
Thank you very much, Caroline. And your point about there being no MEP on the panel, the only answer to that is touché. Do you see a conflict between your description and enthusiasm for deepening the role of the European Parliament with right of initiative and so on? Do you see a conflict between that and the CER proposal for greater involvement of national parliaments, including institutionally?
I don't think there has to be a contradiction between that, no. I mean, I can quite understand that there needs to be a greater linkage between national parliaments and EU institutions, but I don't think that that rules out the European Parliament having more powers as well. I think it would mean that you know, the structural arrangement that you would come to might be slightly more complex, but I think that both of those things need to be in place.
Thank you very much.